if you name it, you own it, right?
I guess so. So here I am. Thank you all very much for inviting me here. It's really going to be a pleasure to talk to some of the high school teachers, because again, I'm going to just repeat what Professor Gross said, and that's that we need students at the at the college level and at the postgraduate level, and the only way to do that is to have them excited about physics and chemistry and science in the secondary school. In fact, the only reason I'm in physics was because of a high school physics teacher in New York. So it's your job to make sure that we have students that we can train to do some of these interesting things that I'll talk to you about today. So I'm gonna introduce the subject of spintronics. Of course, magnetism, spintronics is really just a subset of magnetism, and magnetism has been around for a long time. But actually using the spin in electronics is rather new. And I'm going to actually start this lecture with a quote from somebody I'm sure you all have heard of, Richard Feynman. And he gave a very famous lecture in 1959 at the American Physical Society. And the title of the lecture was "There's Plenty of Room at the Bottom." And a lot of people believe that this was really the genesis of nanoscience, because he was really challenging. He challenged the audience to really get to small things, very small things. And so this is not a direct quote, but he basically challenged the audience to build computers with wires no wider than 100 atoms. Well, we're very close to that. This is really where we'll be, and we'll have devices like that in our computers. A microscope that could view individual atoms, and of course we're there. We have various microscopes that can see things on the atomic scale, even things smaller than the atomic scale. Machines that can manipulate atoms one by one, well, we can do that. We couldn't do it, of course, then. And circuits involving quantized energy levels, of course, were there, or the interaction of quantized spins. So this was actually the end of his quote, and I'll try to point out that we're just about getting there, too. We're at the end of my lecture, I'll talk about being able to manipulate quantum quantized spins. But of course, there's probably even a more famous quote, and that's from Dyot Smith and the comic Dick Tracy. And he said that the nation, he was an industrialist in the comic strip, and he said the nation that controls magnetism controls the universe. So keep that in mind. Okay, so what I'm going to try to convince you is that we have there's plenty of room at the bottom, because conventional electronics, the electronics we use in our computers, the electronics we use in our house, even our toaster, our light bulb, it's all based on moving charges around, the electron and their charges, and the performance ultimately will be limited. In fact, there's dire predictions about the end of the roadmap for semiconductors, maybe in a decade or so. And so is there a way around that? Well, I'm going to try to convince you that spintronics may be one part of the way around that, because now we're using another aspect of the electron, or in fact even nucleons, they have spin. And until very recently, spin has not really been exploited in mainstream electronics. And so instead of being electronics being based on the number of charges and their energy, this type of electronics will be based on direction of spin, spin coupling, and in principle this is capable of better performance than electronics based just on charge. So what I'm going to tell you today, I've outlined this, so I'm going to tell you where there is already some technology. In fact, every one of you, if you have a computer, you have a spintronic device. And this spintronic device is still rather new. I mean, it's only been around for a few years, but you all have one. And I'm going to tell you about a technology that's coming along that you all probably will have very soon. And these are all memory devices. So this type of device is in your hard drive, and this hopefully will be in your computer or in other devices that you have rather soon. And this is much more in the future. This is where I think spins will be going in the next couple of decades. So let me start. So this is a diagram that I'm not sure you all have seen this before, but this is what the density of states looks like in a metal. What you have here is really, as you start putting electrons in a metal, they basically fill this bucket. So this basically tells you how you build up the energy as you add more and more electrons to a metal. And because they're fermions, they all can occupy the same energy level, so you have to, as you put more and more in, their energy goes up. And finally, when you put the last one in, it's at this level, which is the Fermi level. And so in a metal, this is a metal like copper, I've illustrated the spin here, you have equal numbers of spin up and spin down electrons, and usually nobody pays attention. I mean, when you talk about a currents in copper, you don't talk about a spin up and a spin down current. And all of the action really occurs right here at the Fermi level. This is where the electrons can really move around. So all the current is actually carried by electrons right here at the top. But if you have a ferromagnetic metal, the situation is quite different. And in this case, you have a predominance of one type of spin at the Fermi level. This is the level where all of the action occurs. And I've exaggerated this. In fact, in most ferromagnetic metals, you don't have all of the electrons with one spin, but you have most of them. So in fact, there are still some carriers with the spin in the opposite direction. And this fact, which has been known for some time, has only been exploited very recently. Okay, so if you have current going in just an ordinary conductor like copper, you have electrons of both spin coming in, and they sort of scatter nearly the same, and the same current comes out. So as many spin up and spin down go in, come out. And of course, there is scattering. There's scattering of both, and of course, the amount of scattering that you have determines the resistance. So the electrical resistance is something that you have in all types of conducting materials, maybe except superconductors, but that's another lecture, maybe another time. However, in a ferromagnetic conductor, what happens is you could have equal numbers of up and down spins coming in, but this material acts like a filter. So it's a filter of spins. So you put in spins of both signs, both up and down, but what you get is predominantly spins of one direction coming out. So this ferromagnetic metal acts like a filter for spins. And now if you make this interesting structure, which is two ferromagnetic films separated by a non-ferromagnetic metal, this is called a magnetoresistive structure. It turns out that if these two ferromagnets are magnetized in opposite directions. For example, this one would have its north pole over here, and this one would have its north pole over here, then you actually get quite a bit of additional scattering because these electrons polarized this way can't get into this metal, so they scatter, and similarly over here. And so this type of structure, this sandwich, has high resistance if these are magnetized in opposite directions. However, if they're magnetized in the same direction, then these electrons, the carrying spin, if they don't really scatter at this interface because, again, remember, there's a spin filter. So you have most of the electrons coming out of these ferromagnetic metals will have the same spin, and they can go back and forth between these two metals without much trouble. And so this type of orientation has a much lower resistance. And so you can use this device as either a sensor or a storage element. In fact, that's what they've been used for. All you have to do is be able to change the direction of one of the layers relative to the other, and you can change the resistance. Now, what you want to do, of course, is you want to be able to fix one. You want to make sure that one of those magnetic layers stays the same, independent of what you do. And it turns out there's a very clever way of doing that. If you couple this material, which has a moment in this direction, to an anti-ferromagnet, there's some very interesting physics that says this anti-ferromagnet, even though it is not, doesn't have any moment itself, because you have little magnets pointing this way, coupled directly to little magnets pointing that way. Each of these are the atoms, and so the net moment is zero. However, when this is close to a ferromagnet, the layer on top will actually pin the direction of this layer, and so this layer becomes relatively fixed. You know, you can change it, but you have to go to very high magnetic fields in order to switch this layer. But if you make this layer out of a very soft magnetic material, like permalloy, which means it's very easy to change the direction of the moment, then you actually can easily flip the direction, and you can either make, again, a sensor, or you can make a memory element. Now, this effect that I'm talking to you about is relatively recent. So this is really describes the very first experiment that was done. It was done in 1988. So we're talking only less than 20 years of the discovery that you could have this very large change in resistance depending on the relative orientation of these magnetic layers. And you see, for a multi-layer where you introduce many layers of the scattering, the effect was quite large. This is an effect of 110% at room temperature in between the resistance when these are all aligned to when they're anti-aligned. The problem with the device, this multi-layer device, is that the field it takes to actually rotate these layers is quite high. So this is kilogauss. This is thousands of gauss. However, if you make that last structure that I showed you, which is just these two layers, two magnetic layers pinned with the anti-ferromagnet, it turns out that if you only are rotating just this one layer, you actually can do it in a very small field. Fields of just a few gauss. The effect isn't as large. It isn't this 110%. It's maybe 10%. It ranges between 10 and 20%. But look at what the field is. You can do this in fields of just a few gauss. Depending on this, what you choose for this material, you actually can see large changes in the resistance at very low fields. And in fact, as I'll show you in a minute, you can even make this much, much larger by replacing this by a barrier and actually passing the current in the other direction. And so this type of device is called a spin valve. It's a valve that controls spin, just like a water valve. And you can see it has two stable states. So this is the two stable states you can use in a memory. And in fact, it's described by a hysteresis loop. Depending on the material, you could shrink this hysteresis loop to practically zero. So you have something that would be extremely sensitive to small magnetic fields. Thus, you can build a sensor. Right. Let me go back. The y-axis here is resistance. Basically magnetoresistance. So the resistance changes from high when these are anti-aligned to low when they're aligned. Similar to this. The numbers didn't appear. But this is high resistance and this is low resistance. Okay, now I've presented a little more realistic and a little more complicated density of source diagram, and this is for when you have tunneling. So now you have these two ferromagnetic metals, and it's more realistic because, remember, as I said before, there are very few materials that have all of the electrons that are polarized in the same direction. But here what you see is that you have a large majority polarized in one direction and just a small number polarized in the other. So the current is predominantly one type of electron spin, either up or down. And again, you can do the same thing. So if you make these, now if you actually have the current passing through this instead of along it, you actually get a much bigger effect. And in fact, it's the same. So when they're aligned, the resistance is very low. And when they're anti-aligned, the resistance is much higher. And in fact, the goal here, this is the expression, you can look at this. If the two ferromagnetic metals are the same, this is an expression due to Joulier, actually rather early, that the polar is, so if P1 is equal to P2, this would be 2P squared over 1 minus P squared, and you can see if the polarization is perfect, if the polarization in each of these layers is 1, that magnetoresistive ratio would go to infinity. So you can get huge effects when you have this type of geometry. Of course, we really don't have materials that are really perfectly 1. They would be called half metals. If you had a perfectly spin-polarized material, you would call it a half metal, because it only has one kind of spin. But we're trying, in fact, there's a lot of research trying to actually make a half metal and actually put it in a structure like this. And so basically the structure is very similar. One of the magnetic layers you pin with that anti-ferromagnet, and the other layer is free. So tunneling is an interesting process. So when you have conductors and you go from one metal to another, you can understand that the electrons actually are transferred directly through the normal metal. However, if you have an insulator here, the electrons really can't go into the insulator because there's no place for them to go. But if this insulator is thin enough, they can actually tunnel through. And as we said before, this is one of these weird quantum mechanical effects, that the electrons really can't travel through, they tunnel. So this is sort of an artist's conception of tunneling. So you never see any of the electrons in here. But again, this device is a very effective spin filter. So again, if these two layers and the blue and red mean different spin directions, I have a filter that only lets one spin direction through, or very little of the other. So you actually, this would be a very high resistance structure. And of course, if they're aligned, you can see that the current goes through much more readily. You get a much larger current, which means a much lower resistance. So this is actually a much more effective device than a device that I showed you in the beginning. And again, we're talking about relatively new science because people had looked at tunneling as early as 1975, but it was a low temperature effect. In other words, they saw a small effect of change in magnetoresistance, but there was very little magnetoresistance in a tunnel junction at room temperature until about 1994, where basically a group in Japan and a group at MIT actually found a reasonable value of this magnetoresistance ratio at room temperature. And you can see, this is a chart that I borrowed from Stuart Parkin. He's one of the pioneers in this field. And you can see there was a very steady progression of increases in this magnetoresistance ratio. And in fact, even values down here are quite usable. But there was actually a very big change around 2000-2001 when people started looking. So these results were all for an aluminum oxide insulating barrier. But turns out there was some theoretical prediction that MgO should work better. And that theoretical prediction was right around 2000. In fact, it came in the program that I was managing at DARPA at the time. A theorist at the Oak Ridge actually predicted that MgO should work better. And of course, Stuart Parkin immediately started to use that. And these results are results that weren't published until about 2004. And the reason for that was that IBM had made an arrangement with Hitachi. Hitachi didn't want these results to be published. I knew about them because that work was being supported by DARPA, but very few other people knew about it. Of course, eventually this discovery was made elsewhere in Japan, and finally the two papers appeared back to back in 2004. But you can see now this magnetoresistant ratio with MgO is very high. It's not infinity, but it's very high. It's more than 200%. So now I'm going to sort of talk a little bit about where these structures can be used. So there's actually in your computer and in your laptop, there's basically two main types of storage. You have Random access memory, that's your DRAM, and there's SRAM, which is right on your processor chip. These are the memories that all the computations are done. It's fast, but SRAM is expensive and takes up a lot of space. DRAM, you know, when you buy a computer, you have 256 meg of DRAM, 512. DRAM is slower, so it's basically off the main chip. It's rather cheap, but it's volatile, which means you turn off your computer and all the information that's on there goes away. And of course there's flash, which is really coming up very strong. I mean, you finally get in all your little cameras, you find these flash sticks, you can store information. It's very cheap, but it's actually very slow. It actually takes a lot of power. If you start transferring data to your flash stick and you hold it, you'll find it gets quite hot because it uses a lot of power. And you can't write on it many, many times. I mean, the reason that you don't have it doesn't replace DRAM. DRAM, you're constantly reading and writing the data. If you try to read and write the data something like 10,000 times with the flash would no longer be reliable. So it has limited endurance. Now, you have another type of memory in your computer, and that's your hard drive. And that's non-volatile, which means that when you write on it, it stays there. It's supposed to stay for 10 years. And so this is where all your programs are stored when you power down your computer. And so it takes a lot of time. Of course, when you turn your computer on, you have to take the programs that are stored on your hard drive and you have to transfer it to your DRAM. And your DRAM is sort of the memory that operates back and forth with the processor. It turns out that Spintronics has made a big impact here on the hard disk drives. And my guess is that in the next 10 years, it'll have a very big impact here, and I'll try to show you why. Okay, this is sort of a cutaway of what's in your hard drive. So where is the Spintronic device in the hard drive? Well, of course you have the disk where you store the information, and then you have this head, which is on a floater that floats over the disk. It moves back and forth. It has to be very, very close to the disk. In fact, it's only 10 or 15 angstroms above this hard drive. And then right at the very tip of this slider is this device. And this is the device that writes the information. So it's basically, if you all probably have seen one of these electromagnets, it has it has two poles. I'm sorry, it has two poles, and between those poles you generate a very large magnetic field. That's exactly what you have here. Of course, in this case, the pole pieces are extremely close together. The magnetic field is produced right here. There's a fringe field which actually writes, it's an electromagnet, so you can turn it on and off, and it writes the information on your disk. And right next to it is exactly what I showed you before. This multi-layer structure consists of two ferromagnetic films. In this case, it's a spin valve, and of course it has that anti-ferromagnet that pins one layer. And of course, so you read that information by basically changing the resistance of that device. And of course, going to that structure that I showed you, the spin valve, has made a very big difference in the progression of hard drives. So around 1998, IBM was the first to introduce a spin valve into the hard drive. So since 1998, and of course all the companies had to do the same because this was a leap in technology, and you see the change in slope of the density. It allowed the density of these drives to go up dramatically. So where it was only growing at 60%, now there was another type of magnetoresistive head which just used the property of a magnetic material. It turns out that if you have just an ordinary ferromagnet, the resistance depends on the direction of the field. But that's only a 2% effect. Here you had something like a member, it went from 2% to 10%. So that's a very big change in your signal, and that's what allowed this to grow. And of course, what's happened now, just this year, Seagate has introduced a tunnel junction into the head, again, because the signal of a tunnel junction is much larger than the signal of a spin valve. So we're actually seeing the progression of technology from just ordinary magnetoresistance to this giant magnetoresistance, finally to a tunnel junction. And we're headed to something like a terabyte per square inch of information. And of course, what this means is that this is an explosion of information. With it, this is, I mean, if you really, really consider this, in this year, there'll be the total number of bits that will be sold. So this is a number per year would be 100 exabytes. 100 exabytes of data is sold a year, and which means that there's explosion of information. Just about almost soon we'll be able to store everything that's ever been created on these hard drives. But it also creates a problem because the hard drives are only supposed to last for 10 years. So if you put everything that you know on these hard drives, in 10 years it'll all be gone. Anyway, let me now turn back the clock to when I went to DARPA in 1994. And I had the vision at that time, that was even before the spintronic device was in the hard drive. I went and I presented a talk to the director of DARPA asking for funding for a new program which actually became spintronics. In fact, the name spintronics came from that program that I started at DARPA. I needed a catchy title for that program. And so the program was basically spin transport electronics, and so the acronym was spintronics. And this is actually a chart, except for the title, that I showed the director. And what I told him, again, this was really pretty speculative, so this was really science fiction 10 years ago. I said, now, this is a picture of a memory that's still aboard the space shuttle. It's, I'll describe it. It's 128 kilobytes, okay, kilobytes. It weighed 40 pounds. And it cost $250,000. Now, the reason, I mean, there were cheaper memories, of course, but the reason was that this was radiation hard, non-volatile, and extremely robust. It's still aboard, it's still on a lot of our strategic assets, and it's on almost every satellite. And what I told the director was that I was going to replace this with a chip. That was the vision that I had in 1996. And of course the chip was a memory chip based on this spin-dependent tunneling. And I'll show you where this has come. And of course I said also that as a sidelight we would develop a whole bunch of magnetic sensors. Not the sensor for the hard drive, because IBM was already working on that. I mean, we had a workshop and IBM was well on their way. Of course it still took 4 years. Actually, from 96, it took 2 years, but I actually started talking about this program 2 years before. So it actually took 2 years to get it all in place. And this MRAM, which we is now called MRAM, basically works in a very simple way. So again, here's that tunnel junction. Here's that same structure that I showed you before. So this is a layer that's fixed. And again, I don't show that anti-ferromagnet, but it's there. So you have one magnetic layer that's fixed and one magnetic layer that's free. So this can move back and forth. And depending on which direction it is, either you have a high resistance. So this is now that missing access from before. This is basically the same thing. So this is in basically resistance area. So this is the high resistance state, this is the low resistance state. So these are the two states of the memory, 1 and 0. And the way you flip this layer is you put currents in these two lines. And basically these two lines, if you put a current in, you produce a magnetic field. And if you have currents in two directions, you basically can produce a rotating magnetic field that rotates this layer. So you can rotate this layer by putting a current in these two directions. In fact, if you put current in only one direction, then you basically shrink this hysteresis loop, and then when you put current in the other direction, it collapses completely, and that's how you switch this memory. At this case, this is circa 2002. This was demonstrated by Motorola, and they were part of this DARPA spintronics program. There were three companies working, and a large number of universities. The three companies were IBM, Motorola, and Honeywell, and they were all really trying to develop very similar types of memory. And let me show you that. In fact, here is the hierarchy. This is really what came out of that spintronics program. So. I didn't put the years on, but I can sort of tell you this was 1999. This was a 1 kilobit memory that was made by IBM. This was the first significant memory. It was 256 kilobyte made by Motorola. This was in basically 2001-2002. Motorola then made a 1 megabit memory. This is a 1 megabit memory. This was around 2003. Freescale, now of course Motorola split out its semiconductor products sector that became Freescale. So in fact Freescale continued working on this, and they actually came up with a very novel way of switching that bit. I don't have time to go into it. It's called a toggle switch. It still uses two lines, it still uses magnetic field, but it's a very clever way which got rid of a very significant problem with what I call conventional switching. And now IBM has this 16 megabit memory pictured here. And they're also, since this toggle idea was so good, IBM is actually going to be using this toggle method of switching as well. So this is really the hierarchy of what was produced in that DARPA program. And Motorola has this chip out to its customers, and I have to say this chip is actually in several devices as we speak today. The physical dimensions of the chip is about 1/4 inch by 1/4 inch. Okay, the switching speed I'll go back. The switching speed is right now is at 10 nanoseconds. So it's right in the ballpark of DRAM, and it's not as fast. SRAM typically could be as fast as 1 nanosecond. DRAM is typically in the 10 to 20 nanosecond range. And flash is way up there. It's microsecond. So, I mean, it's way faster. It's comparable to DRAM. I actually have a chart of all of those parameters, but unfortunately I didn't put it in this presentation. But what I really want to show you is this chip, which is a fully radiation-hardened chip. It's actually a collaboration between Honeywell and Freescale. These were two of the participants. And it's on what's called silicon on insulator. So the conventional circuits that are used are very rad hard. Silicon on insulator is the way to make rad hard CMOS. It has to be non-volatile, so you can't use CMOS as a non-volatile memory. You have to use something else. And so this is a chip that actually was produced this year by this collaboration. The first time it went out of the foundry at the Freescale, it used what we call front end of the line. It used all of the control circuitry made by Honeywell, and on top, Freescale put on this all the magnetics and these lines to switch it. And the first run was a big success. They got many chips that had no errors. And of course, so I felt very good about this. And in fact, the Navy now is going to put this into their upgrade of their strategic assets. So this is actually going to appear in DoD systems starting in 2008. And so this dream in 1996 has actually, of course, this was just a fake chip that I put on here. But as you can see, that's exactly what happened. And so we do have a rad-hard chip to replace this this very clunky memory. I have to say that there was a memory just like this on the Challenger. And when they recovered parts of the Challenger from the ocean, they actually did recover a memory. And Honeywell brought it. Honeywell produced these memories in Clearwater, Florida. They brought it back to Clearwater, and in fact, it was fully functional. So that's how robust these memories have to be. I'll tell you just a little story. So when I actually presented this chart to the director of DARPA, I didn't just present a chart. I actually took one of these memories and put it on his desk. Because I worked at the Naval Research Laboratory at the time, I actually split my time, and NRL had a satellite division that were building satellites, and in fact, when they were building satellites in 1996, this is exactly the memory that they were using, and since I knew the director, they actually unbolted one from the satellite they were putting together, put it in an aluminum case, and I brought it to DARPA and I put it on his desk and I said, okay, we're going to replace this with a chip. If you give me $100 million, actually it was $50 million, I will do that. And so he did. And I did. Anyway, so here's a little summary of this part. So Spintronics is already going to make an impact. So, you know, it's not just the dream of the future. So it's had a major impact on the hard drive storage. It's enabled a 400 times increase in the storage capacity since 1998 when it was introduced. And of course it makes possible all these little miniature drives. In fact, the iPod, the high storage iPods have little hard drives in it. I visited Seagate recently and they have a hard drive that has exactly the same form factor as one of these flash chips that goes in the camera. So you could take out the flash card and put in a 20 gigabyte drive that looks just like the flash card that you put in your camera. This is a new product that they will be introducing. So of course, you know, flash is, there's going to be a competition between flash and hard drives. Of course, as you can see, it makes from that chart of how many bits of information can you store. I mean, it boggles my mind that you actually can store 100 exabits. I mean, I didn't even know what an exabit was until I saw that chart. 10 to the 18th. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about something that's quite a bit different. And in fact, it also is a program that I started at DARPA. It was called SPINS, and of course, UCSB played a major role in this program. It's a program that hasn't 5 minutes. Okay, that has played a major role in the development of, the future. And this was, again, a chart that I showed the director. And actually, this was shown in 1998. And it was based on two major discoveries. One was a room temperature optically induced quantum. Now we're talking about a special quantum state in semiconductors. The idea here is that you could create, by shining circularly polarized light on a semiconductor, you could create a very coherent spin state. And it lasted for much longer time than anybody had anticipated. And it makes possible the idea of using this coherent spin state in a whole bunch of neat ways. And the other discovery was basically a really new type of magnetic material. It's a magnetic semiconductor where the magnetism is produced by a very dilute doping of a magnetic element. So only 5% in manganese in gallium arsenide made it magnetic at 120 Kelvin. So this wasn't room temperature. So it wasn't, you know, the end of the road, because we needed to be able to increase this temperature. But these two discoveries were very important. I felt that there should be quite a bit of money invested. And this is, again, a picture out of one of the publications from UCSB. Basically, what you do is you shine a circularly polarized light on an area in the semiconductor. It produces basically a coherent magnetic state, and you can use optical techniques to study it. And of course, in this experiment, there was a small electric field that was able to move this, basically this little puddle of magnetism in the semiconductor, and you can see it could move over quite long distances, distances that are quite interesting for semiconductor devices. And in fact, the same thing, you could introduce this state even in very small quantum dots. And let me say that the first potential application of this spin coherence could be in a very high-speed optical modulator that you might want to use in optical networks. This was something that was demonstrated at the University of Iowa, and they showed that you actually can modulate a polarized light beam at up to a couple of terahertz. So that's really much higher than most modulators work. It's an all-optical modulator, and this uses that same sort of physics of inducing this magnetic state that actually can be used to change the direction of a polarized beam. I'm going to, in the last few minutes, I'm going to basically introduce one more topic. And that's now, again, something that maybe Feynman was anticipating. It turns out that we have two very interesting techniques that have come along in the last decade. One is magnetic resonance imaging, where you can use, again, a type of magnetic resonance to do 3D imaging of all sorts of biological objects. And of course, we also now have the scanning probe microscopes that could actually look at individual atoms, but only on a surface. So this is a 3D. This is a 3D imaging, but it doesn't have very good resolution. You can't see single atoms or single spins here. You can see something like 10 to the 12. So you can't really get down to very small numbers. Here you can actually see individual atoms, but only on the surface. Wouldn't it be nice if you could marry these two techniques so you could do 3D imaging of all sorts of interesting objects? And in fact, this now has been done. One of the main motivations is there's millions of proteins in our body that we don't know what the structure is, because we can't actually go in there. We can't crystallize them when we don't have a probe that can look at the position of the individual atoms. There is something called a magnetic resonance force microscope. And since I don't have time to fully explain it, I'll tell you that it operates on both principles. It uses a cantilever with a little magnet. The magnet produces a field gradient, exactly as produced in MRI, but of course everything is now on the nanoscale. So this field gradient can pick out, somewhere in this field gradient, you have exactly the right field to be resonant, if you have an RF coil, to be resonant with a single spin. And so let me just show you the movie. And you can watch it and start asking questions. So this is how this works. So you have this spin. What happened? Oh. Let me start it again. Okay, so you have the spin. Now you turn on the RF and you produce what's called this resonance slice. This is the slice where you exactly cause resonance of the spin as it goes through. You basically flip the spin. And so actually you can detect this. Whenever this interacts, the frequency of this cantilever is changed slightly. You pick up this change, this slight change in frequency with an optical interferometer. So this looks like a very simple device. In fact, in principle it's very simple. In practice it took 10 years to actually build this. And in fact, very recently, last year, this is the cantilever. You can see it's only 100 nanometers thick. It has to be extremely soft so that it can actually change its frequency when it interacts with a spin. By the way, you're detecting forces of an attonewton. An attonewton, that's 10 to the minus 18 newtons. That's the force that's exerted on this cantilever. And just to show you, and this is the little magnet, the little tiny magnet at the end of the cantilever. And I'll end with this. This was a remarkable, in fact, the American Institute of Physics called this the most significant piece of work of last year. the detection of a single spin. It's a defect in silicon dioxide. And so this is an achievement, and I think it will lead the way to really remarkable instrumentation in the future. And at this, I'm going to stop. And again, thank you for listening.
Okay, this presentation is open for questions.
The storage, it should be for the MRAM, it should be infinite. And you never can test it, but certainly it's 10 years. I mean, the requirement is 10 years. I mean, you know, everything, if you're at a finite temperature, you know, if you wait long enough, you'll probably have an error. But the energy gap between switching and not switching is something like 50 times KT. So I don't know if you're familiar, but typically you measure the lifetime by what the energy barrier is divided. It's E to the energy barrier against switching divided by KT. And so if you have that E to the 50, that's enormous length of time. So that's what that's how long the information should last without decaying. Yeah.
Talk about what an antiferromagnet is.
An antiferromagnet?
Yeah.
It's a material that inside it's like having a very nanoscopic array of ferromagnets that are magnetized in opposite directions. So you have one line, say, of atoms that are polarized to the left. The next one is polarized to the right, and so you build up the stack. And but of course, it's very difficult. These layers of magnetic materials are very, very tightly coupled. So it's very hard to actually rotate them. So the we call it the anisotropy is extremely large internally. So effectively, there's a very large magnetic field. And so right at the surface, if you're very close to that surface, you actually have a very large magnetic field. It doesn't propagate very far, but right at that surface, it's very high. So now if you put another ferromagnet on top, it effectively is pinned by this very large field that's right next to it due to this this layer that's really fixed. It's fixed because of the alternating layers of magnetism internal to the material.
On your spin valves, particularly the tunneling one,
right?
Both of those relied on the scattering was different if the spin was different. And so in my mind, I got this picture of this evanescent field, but I don't see why the evanescent field would be different when the spin is one direction versus the other.
It's just a matter of it's not so much the evanescent field. It's a matter of where can a spin go. So if you remember this density of states diagram, let's consider the ideal one. So you have only states. So if you have these two magnetic layers anti-aligned, so you have spins of one direction here. On the other side, there's no place for those spins to go because there's no states that have the right spin on the other side. So in order for you to have transfer of carriers, there have to be states for them to go into. And they have to be not only a state that you can put a charge in, but in this case, there has to be a state where you actually can put a spin in. And so if there are no states, then you won't have any transfer of carriers because you have to have states at the Fermi level. Well, it's Pauli exclusion argument, exactly. So there's no place for them to go, and therefore they don't tunnel. So that's why it's a very effective filter. So that's why it's a spin filter.
Right here.
Yeah.
I think I heard you say this twice, but I was so surprised I want to make sure I heard it right. You said that on the hard drives we're using today, we're using some of this tunneling technology?
Yes.
And so I can go home and tell my students that we today have quantum computers.
If you buy a Seagate, no, it's not a quantum computer.
Well, computers that are using quantum techniques?
Well, it's using, well, I mean, there are a lot of tunnel devices. I mean, this is a spin tunneling device. I mean, in a sense, a lot of the transistors that are here are also tunneling devices, but it only is based on tunneling of charge. There's no spin involved. I mean, you don't care what the direction of the spin is. Right. So there are already tunnel devices in your computer, but this is the first spin tunneling device that operates because you're controlling the spin, not just the charge. So that's the big difference. And so the first application of a spin tunnel junction is again in the sensor for a hard drive. And that was introduced just this year by Seagate. They're the first to actually introduce a tunnel sensor. And so again, the idea is to keep performance going up as you make the tracks. I mean, what makes the density higher is that you can put more information on these tracks. As you make the bit size smaller and smaller, you need a more and more sensitive detector. And so that's been the progression. So you go from a sensor where the signal is only 2% to 10% to 20%, and now we have tunnel junctions where you can get as high as 300% change in resistance. Well, that's a very hard question. That's more of a question for a theorist. But what it means is that there are two properties. Again, I'm going to use the word property. But again, there's charge, spin is angular momentum. So it means that the electron has angular momentum. So something, and I can't tell you what, something is spinning, but I don't think anybody knows the base, what's spinning in an electron. Maybe somebody else could tell you what. But it's funny. I have the same discussion with one of the other faculty members at UVA. He says, "Okay, so what's spinning in an electron?" And I say, "I don't know what's spinning, but it has angular momentum. So something is there's something." That's giving it angular momentum. So the property is angular momentum. Where it comes from, I'm not prepared to answer. Yeah.
In sandwich of the two ferromagnetic layers that you had, there was a layer in between that was non-ferromagnetic.
Correct.
What was the role of that? Why do we need that layer, actually?
You need actually to have somewhere where you actually produce an excess of spin. It's slightly complicated, but you don't need very much. In fact, that layer is really very thin. You actually could in principle make a device with a very little bit of a non-magnetic layer. But what would happen is that you would have too strong an interaction between these two ferromagnetic layers. They would couple too strongly, and so you wouldn't be able to rotate one as freely as you could if you separate them by some distance. So it's really just acting as a spacer to separate these two ferromagnetic layers. If you put one on top of another, they become too strongly coupled. So you couldn't rotate one and not have a strong effect on the other one. Yeah.
Is there a corresponding increase in speed that's associated with how quickly these sensors read?
It turns out, the larger the signal you have, in other words, the larger the magnetoresistive ratio, the faster you can read it, because it means that you don't have to average the signal. Everything in terms, when you read a signal, you have to make sure you get it right. And so the time you need to read it, the time you need to look at that signal is proportional to the size of that signal. The bigger the signal, the faster you can read it. So in fact, there is. In fact, for the MRAM, not so much for the sensor, but for the MRAM, the big signal is very important because the read time will definitely go down as the signal goes up. And so the memory that I showed you, built by Freescale, operates at about 10 nanoseconds. And that was built with a ratio of about 40% change in the magnetoresistance. If you go up by an order of magnitude, you would actually be able to read it at just 1 or 2 nanoseconds. So with this new, with these new materials, the MGO, in principle you could significantly reduce the read time, and that's really important because now it's approaching the read time of SRAM. And so it's becoming closer and closer to what we would call a universal memory.
Hi. Over here.
Okay.
Can you envision any simplified lab exercises for students to experience these technologies? Off the top of your head.
Yeah, there are. There's a company called TeachSpin. There's a company called TeachSpin, and they're located in Buffalo. And a lot of they have basically lab instruments that they're producing for I think mostly for college laboratories, but they're not that expensive. And a lot of these concepts can be taught using some of their demonstration equipment. In fact, I know the person who founded that company used to be in the office next to me in Cleveland at Case Western Reserve, and so. So if you look them up on the web, you might find some teaching materials. And in fact, even if you don't buy the instrumentation, he has very nice manuals that go through this that could be used for teaching.
Okay, other questions?
Yeah. Well, okay, what I mean by universal memory, right now what do we have in this laptop? We have a hard drive, okay. We have DRAM, we have SRAM, and if you have a stick, memory stick, you have flash. So there's basically, I just described to you four types of memories that are used. If you have a memory that incorporates all of the properties of all of them, then in fact you could replace that four with one memory. So the main advantage. So we already can probably replace the DRAM and the SRAM because we have comparable performance with an additional factor that it's non-volatile. Remember, it's non-volatile, where DRAM and SRAM are volatile. In other words, if you turn off the power on your computer, the DRAM and the SRAM would lose all its information. If you had MRAM in there, it would not. So think of this, that you're probably still going to need a hard drive, because a hard drive has so much more. To make the kind of storage on an MRAM that it was comparable to the hard drive, it would be very, very expensive. A hard drive is very inexpensive. So you probably would still need a hard drive to store all of your archival data. But if you had DRAM replaced with MRAM, you turned off your computer, everything would remain. It would be exactly where you left off. You wouldn't need a battery. You wouldn't need any power. You turn on the switch, you wouldn't have to transfer all of that information from your hard drive, at least the programs. The programs could remain on the MRAM. Of course, all of your data and everything else that you archive would still be on your hard drive. So you could basically replace every memory that you have on your computer with one memory. That's why it's universal. In principle, if you really wanted to have a very small computer, if you really were worried about size, you could actually even have a sort of a pocket device that had no hard drive and just had MRAM. So that's really the benefit.
You started the talk with the Feynman quote. Just thinking about the kids that we're having in school now, I'm sure some of those things seem pretty daunting back in 1959.
Right.
How would you update that for the technologies available today?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So, I didn't show you this, but this is actually computing with single spins. And of course, so what I would tell them is that ultimately we'll have a computer that is as powerful, and you'll probably hear this at the end of the day, a computer as powerful or more powerful than any of these computers using quantum information. So with 1,000 qubits, you could do everything that you do with millions and millions of conventional bits. Now, getting to there is going to take probably as long from today as it did from Feynman's 59 to get to where we are today. So that's the vision. You tell them that you're going to build a quantum, there's going to be a quintel inside. And so building a quantum computer is going to be, in my mind, the next sort of vision. where there's room at the bottom, or even below the bottom, anyway.
The next question, way back in the back, was I noticed on your last slide you showed the conditions that were took place where you measured that stuff, and you measured at 1.6 Kelvin, which is not hard for us to live in.
Well, no, you're not going to measure these proteins. You're not going to measure these proteins in your body. You're going to, in fact, the proteins where we do know the structure are typically measured by already by some sort of cryomicroscopy. And the reason is that you have to really kill a lot of the motions. And the way you kill the motions is by going to low temperature. So you'll still be doing the microscopy at low temperature. However, you'll be able to do it on a single molecule. Whereas now you can't really do any type of structure determination on a single molecule. You have to have millions of them, and typically you crystallize them. What this will enable you to do, even though you still have to do it cold, is you can do it on one single molecule and determine the structure, the crystal structure.
Okay, yeah. One last question.
It's just about there. I would say this year. It's going to be commercially available this year. In fact, if it was supposed to be available a few months ago. Freescale is still sampling it. So right now it's beta. It's in a beta version, which means that customers have it, they could use it, but you can't just go on eBay and buy it at the moment. But maybe at the end of this year you will be able to. It's probably going to be in specialized equipment, high-end small devices. And the reason is it's still much more expensive than DRAM, and so you won't find it in the normal laptop that you buy at Circuit City. It'll probably appear in two ways: one in military systems probably first, and probably in very specialized products. What we call ASICs in the next year or two, and I would say it would appear in a laptop maybe 4 to 5 years from now. It'll be in the regular commercial devices.
Okay, I'd like to thank Professor Wolf for a stimulating presentation, and all of you for excellent questions.
Yeah, I'll be here all day.
We're now to our break, but there's opportunity to ask a lot more questions informally, and we'll be back here at 10:30 for the next talk.